Chapter 41. 40 minutes could feel like a long, long time. They flipped him onto his belly and cuffed his hands over his head rather than behind his back. It happened quickly enough that he didn't have time to struggle. Then Lola sliced his shirt right off his back. "What's this?" she asked, and Neil had to swallow the sudden bolt of remembered terror. "Oh, sweetheart. You know, Rico was so sure he'd beaten that propensity out of you. Blood is thicker than that, though, isn't it?" She wrenched the switchblade, the same one Renee had passed over to him, that Andrew had bought after taking back his own, off of his hip and threw it away so it skidded over the concrete. Neil, his cheek held hard to the floor with the way his arms were pinned, watched it flash in the light as it spun before coming to a halt. It was so far out of his reach that it may as well have been back in his drawer at Palmetto. "You know, boys like you are meant to be declawed," she said, putting a knee into his lower back. It wasn't meant to hurt. It was another method of restraint. He felt the cold whisper of steel on the back of his neck, tracing the familiar arc of the scar there. Lola said, "You've already cost the Moriyamas. Really, it's surprising that they let you get away with that one." Neil didn't answer. He'd broken the player who'd given him the bite scar because he was a danger to Jean and Neil in particular, and because he was worth much less than either of them. He'd been punished for it, severely, but Tetsuji had looked at Neil like he was something familiar afterwards, called him Wisninski, with an added weight to the syllables. Neil hated that name. He hated the entirety of what was written on his birth certificate, including the Abram that his mother had called him right before she died. He wasn't Nathaniel anymore. Not really. He'd excised his father from his sense of self, and he refused to die with someone else's name. He might not get a choice about what went on his headstone, if he got lucky enough to have one at all, but everyone who mattered would remember him as Neil. He could hear it said over and over in different voices. Himself, with no trace of trauma. Wisninski was different, though, for all that he despised it. Neil wasn't Nathan, but he was undeniably his father's son. He had blood dripping from his hands to prove that. "That child has no sense of artistry," Lola critiqued, running the blade of her knife along the webbing of silvery scars over Neil's shoulder blades. She didn't press down hard, but it was so sharp that it left a stinging impression of its path that set his skin to itching. "I suppose you're a real artisan," Neil ground out. The knife pressed down harder. "I certainly am. What did the special agent want from you in Colombia?" Of course she knew about that. Kengo had. "To advise me to make better life choices," Neil replied, and then tensed despite himself. It didn't help. Nothing ever did. Somehow not being able to see the wound made it hurt worse, feeding into the panic that suddenly gripped him about the throat. Even years of punishments, of torture, just like this, didn't mean he could tell without seeing how bad it was, and for a moment, he was sure she'd killed him already. "That would have been too easy, though," she said. "Try again." "Fuck you," Neil spat, and didn't make another sound as she cut him again, then again, then again. She had a lot of questions. About Browning, about Rico and Tetsuji, about Proust, and about the foxes. There was only so long that Neil could hold out, with Lola at his back and the others dead silent but watchful in the background. He saved his silence for the ones who mattered, and that wasn't anyone with the last name Moriyama. For them, Neil answered every query Lola had. After a while, she got tired of whatever she was doing to the skin across his shoulder blades and pushed up onto her knees so the men holding Neil's hands and feet could flip him. The feel of concrete against the mess of his back was enough to make his teeth grind together, but it still wasn't worse than being nose to nose with Lola while she crouched over him. "Apparently, I'm meant to save anything worse than cosmetic for when your father arrives," she said, tracing the knife, now washed red, over his jaw and upwards towards his hairline. "But I figured he wouldn't mind if I took an eye." They'd moved on from him answering questions then. Neil let his eyes close as she passed the knife over his jaw and up to his ear and then across. He felt the kiss of the tip against his eyelid and could do nothing but wait with nowhere to go. Or, Lola interrupted herself, lifting the knife away. Neil couldn't stop the breath he'd been holding from blowing out between his teeth in a hiss, which drew a laugh from her. The relief lasted until she went on with, "Maybe a finger." She leaned forward and grabbed one of his wrists, forcing it harder to the floor so his back arched and ground into the concrete. He couldn't stop the whine that forced itself out of his mouth at that. He bit off the noise at the firm touch of the blade perpendicular over the smallest finger on his right hand. "I guess you probably value this, but you aren't going to need it anymore," she said.
"What do you want from me?"
Neil asked through his teeth. "You've already given me what I want," she said. "Now it's the fun part, right? You must remember this. Usually I would save it for after you're already dead, but I figure just this once we might change things up." Neil did remember. Lola's job was trashing bodies and disposing of them, and she was very good at it. After all, his mother's body had never been found. His wouldn't be either. Lola said, "Look at me, Nathaniel." He looked at her and didn't make a sound as she pushed until the knife met concrete. For a long moment, it felt like nothing. Then, like a white-hot star centered over his head imploding, wiping the rest of him out. He might have cried out in the aftermath. He might have not. He had no idea. His mouth tasted distinctly of blood, though he didn't remember biting down. He'd mastered pain before. He breathed out, slow and shallow, and forced it down until his vision blinked clear. Through the roaring in his ears, he heard Lola said, "Oh, look who's here." There was a massive clatter as the big garage door across the warehouse rolled up. Lola let go of his wrist and sat up at last, pushing herself to her feet. Neil closed his eyes, pulling his still-cuffed hands down from over his head to rest over his heart. There was the sound of car doors slamming and voices echoing against the metal walls, bouncing around the empty inside of his skull. "Nathaniel," said a voice that Neil heard sometimes in his nightmares. He opened his eyes, because that was a command. Nathan Wisninski looked the same as he had when Neil last saw him, before his imprisonment, and before Neil had left Castle Evermore. He'd been 16, and his father had come to do something for the Moriyamas before he'd stopped by to watch the Ravens practice. He hadn't said anything, had stayed high up in the North Tower, but Neil had felt his father's eyes where he wore the number 3 on his back. He crouched down at Neil's feet, elbows on his knees. "My son, what a long fall from grace." Neil said nothing. "Grace isn't what I would call it. I hoped that sending you to Tetsuji would mean an end to me having to deal with you, but apparently not," Nathan went on. "What, you have nothing to say? I was told that you've spent months with your mouth open. Stupid." His father's eyes passed over his face, then down to where his hands were curled together on his chest. The corner of his mouth curved up, though his eyes were still glacial. Neil recognized that expression from the mirror. "Was it worth it? A few months of pretending you were free?" Nathan asked. "You must have known it couldn't last." Neil had known. Every minute of every day since he'd put pen to paper in Wimac's office. It had started off a whisper so deep inside he hadn't even acknowledged it. But he was hollow. Even a whisper resonated eventually. That echo had been all-encompassing in Wimac's office hours ago, but now it was silent. Everything was, with his heart struck dead. Nathan said, "Answer me." It was a threat. "Yes," Neil replied quietly. "Hmm," Nathan said. "I'm not sure you'll still think so before it's all over." Maybe not quite dead. Neil felt the tickle of anger in the back of his throat. If there was going to be anything left of him, it was this. Anger in his own name. "Do you think so?" Neil asked. His voice sounded rough but clear, and the touch of rage that sizzled over his tongue was audible. There was a shift in Nathan's expression in response. The smirk turned businesslike. "I'll take the rest of your fingers first. Then perhaps your legs," he said. "Then I'll ask you again." He turned to Romero, who hovered behind his shoulder. "Get him up." Demacio, Nathan's personal bodyguard, and the man who Neil's mother had feared almost as much as Nathan himself, stepped in to help with removing Neil's cuffs and pulling him to his feet. They weren't gentle about it. Neil, his hurt hand over his heart still, didn't make a sound. He looked around once they stepped back from him, like prey looking for an escape route. He stood alone in the center of the circle of cars, the gaps between filled with the indistinct forms of his father's men. They watched on unmoving, like stone. If Neil tried to bolt, they would stop him. That was the only reason that they'd removed the cuffs at all. The sun was going down outside, the clear panels in the roof showing slashes of pink and violet instead of blue. Neil looked up at them and thought it had really been too much to hope for, that they would make it quick. Nathan rounded one of the cars, walking towards Neil. In one hand he held a cleaver, the tool for which he'd gained his nickname. Neil remembered suddenly and distinctly how it felt cutting through flesh. He had a scar on his belly from where Nathan had used it on him before. "Before we get down to business, I have one more thing to say," Nathan said, as he stepped within arm's reach and then grabbed Neil around the throat. He choked. It was just a threat, seeing as he relaxed his fingers an instant later, but it left Neil hanging in his grip, gasping. "Jackson should have been here by now. That means he ran into trouble back in Palmetto." Neil didn't dare hope for anything. Any hope would have been smothered anyway, when Nathan went on. "And that means your whole team is going to have to go, too. You really should have stayed where you were supposed to, Nathaniel." "Don't touch them," Neil snarled, his voice barely making it from his throat. "Leave them alone." "You could beg," Nathan suggested, all white teeth and a snarl of a grin. Another reason he and Lola got on so well. They had the same taste in sadism. "Not a fucking chance," Neil replied, and took the backhanded blow he got for that without a whimper. When Nathan let go of him, his knees went out from under him, and he landed hard on his hands. The shriek of agony from his right one, that he didn't dare look at, nearly made him black out. "Do you want me to hold him?" Lola asked from behind Neil. He hadn't heard her approach. Neil realized quite suddenly that they didn't, even after everything, expect him to put up a fight. Nothing outside of what a normal person would do in the face of being tortured to death. That was fair. As far as they knew, that's what he was. Not entirely. He had months of experience training with a woman who could face off with any of these people with a knife in hand and walk away in a fair fight. A woman who would almost certainly win if that fight wasn't a fair one. And Neil was bleeding, but he'd fought through being broken before. Neil wasn't Renee. He wouldn't win, but he could make the cost of killing him a little dearer if he tried hard enough. He didn't hear what Nathan said to Lola, but he felt her hands clamp down on his shoulders. He moved. Dragging one foot up beneath him, he exploded out of his crouch. His skull impacted with her chin, and her hands disappeared from him. He wheeled around, following up with a punch to the throat with his left hand that made her gag. He wished he had a knife. He kicked her backwards hard enough to break ribs instead, and then turned back towards Nathan. He was fast, but his father was too, and he wasn't losing blood from multiple places. He collided with Neil knee first as Neil faced him, driving him down onto the ground with him on top, and pressed the cleaver to Neil's throat. It was razor sharp. Neil felt it break skin even just with the light pressure of it against the thrashing pulse point just under the skin. "Naughty," Nathan commented, his playful tone not matching the black look in his eyes. "I suppose the cuffs will have to go back on. You know you aren't allowed to break my things." Neil had learned that lesson as a 4-year-old. There was no point in speaking. He closed his eyes and thought, not enough, and then resigned himself all over again. There was a knock at the massive door on the other side of the warehouse, the hard, singular rap of a fist. Every single one of them, down to Neil's father, stopped to look. Then, before anyone could say a word, Nathan's guards turned on each other. Someone in Neil's peripheral vision went down instantly with a bullet wound. They whizzed through the air like bees. Even Nathan hunkered down, eyes narrowing. Over his father's shoulder, Neil could see DiMaggio bolting for his boss. There was a 50-50 chance that Nathan would slit his throat here and now, rather than give him the opportunity to flee in the chaos. Nathan's eyes flickered back to Neil, but before he could make a decision either way, Neil kicked up one leg and kneed him hard in the belly. With his balance gone, Nathan dropped his weight onto his free hand to prevent himself from falling to the floor. The other that held the cleaver, forced upward, avoided the fragile line of Neil's carotid artery, but sliced deep into the underside of his jaw. DiMaggio snatched Nathan away then, leaving Neil sprawled in place on the ground, clutching at his neck with his good hand. There was nowhere for him to go with bullets flying overhead, even if he could go anywhere. So he huddled down in place and tried not to think about how hot and wet his fingers felt. It seemed like forever before the sound of gunshots died out, but it must have been only minutes. There was a clattering crash as the door rolled up again, which Neil could just see from where he was lying. Black figures poured out of the twilight, most of them armed. Neil didn't recognize them on sight, but he could tell they weren't cops. They were too quiet for that. Nathan was snarling something. Someone replied, and then there was another gunshot, starker for being alone. Lola shrieked, the sound echoing in the rafters overhead. "Nathaniel," said a familiar voice, British accent. "Nathaniel, shit." Neil blinked. Someone pulled his hand away from his throat and pushed down against the wound, hard enough that the breath left him again. He made some kind of noise, though his ears were ringing enough that he didn't really make it out. "Easy," someone else said. He couldn't get his breath back, not properly. It felt like he was inhaling the dark from outside, like it was blitzing out his vision. He let it overtake him. Chapter 42. When Neil came to, it was to movement and sound. It took him a moment to connect the two things with their origin. He was in a moving car, rocking gently, with the smooth shifts in the road and hearing the quiet roar of an engine cruising in high gear. He panicked. But the first movement he made sent pain flashing jagged over his back, through his jaw, and into his aching skull. There was someone leaning over him, but they caught his hand in an iron grip before he could hit them. "Easy," they said. Their voice and that word brought him back into his body and slowed his gasping. He opened his eyes. The car was dark. He had no idea how long it had been, but it was well beyond twilight now. He was wrapped up in fabric, a jacket, he realized, as his hand was returned to him, and strapped in like a sleepy child around it. "You wouldn't want to punch with that right now," the woman said. Her accent was distinctly British, though one of the less pretty varieties. "Do you remember what happened?" Neil started to reply, and then stopped at the agonizing pull of opening his mouth. He touched the fingers of his other hand to his throat and met the slick material of a dressing over the underside of his jaw and up onto his cheek. "It's cosmetic," the woman said. "I mean, it's nasty, but it didn't hit anything important. I stitched it up. The rest of you, too. You're not in danger of bleeding out anymore. You're going to need some very good antibiotics, and your hand could use some work, but that can wait until we get to where we're going."
"Where?"
Neil croaked out, more a command than a question. "We're heading back to New York, and then to England, and we're taking you with us," came a second voice. That was Stuart, turned around in the front passenger seat. Neil could just make out the lines of his face in the dim light of the dashboard, more familiar from his memories of his mother than from the weeks the two of them had spent in the Hatford household when Neil was a child.
"You can't," Neil informed him.
He stretched his jaw until it started to loosen up, ignoring the jarring pain of it.
The Moriyamas won't let this one go.
Neil didn't know what exactly they'd left behind, but from his fractured memories, the single gunshot, Lola's scream, he thought he could imagine. Kengo would chase them to the ends of the earth for ending the Butcher's reign before it could begin again. I seem to recall you have a plan in place for them, Stuart said. He wasn't wrong.
I don't think I need it just yet, Neil rasped.
His brain, rattled and slow, was still quick to start pulling things together. Lola's questions, something Higgins had said, a thin spiderweb of information that stretched across the country and centered on a pair of men. Brothers. The ones who Neil knew made him glad he was an only child. He said,
I need to talk to the Moriyamas, face to face.
Kengo won't be seeing you anytime soon. He's still in the hospital. Kidney problems, Stuart said. I don't think he has all that long in the grand scheme of things.
It's fine. Ichiro's the one I need to speak with, Neil replied. What are you going to do? How are you here?
We were watching Wozninski's house. He wasn't supposed to leave, but when he did, we followed him, Stuart explained. I figured if we were ever going to get a shot at him, this was it.
Neil nodded.
That was the bargain he'd made in exchange for Proust's death just before Christmas break. Information on what had become of Mary Hatford, and all the information that Stuart wanted on Nathan Wozninski and his people. Neil hadn't bothered to ask what he intended to do with that information. He hadn't cared. Now, he did, but only in one respect.
Is he dead?
Stuart's eyes were black holes in his face in the dim light, but Neil could feel the full weight of his attention.
Yes.
Neil wanted to ask, are you sure? He thought that might be offensive, but there was a sick desperation in him that came from being caught between disbelief and wanting so badly for Stuart to be telling the truth. Nathan had long faded to more of a nightmare figure in the back of Neil's mind, behind Tetsuji and Riko and the Ravens. The last however many hours had brought home just how real a threat he still was to Neil, or had been. Neil wished he'd been able to see the body for himself, see the life drain out of the man who'd been so ready to take him apart. He didn't think he'd be able to sleep again until he could believe the heavy surety of Stuart's yes. He wasn't sure how long that would take. He also supposed he had a deal to keep with Agent Browning. Come back again when my father is dead, and maybe I'll give you what you want. When Neil had said, we'll see who pulls the trigger first, back in an interrogation room in Columbia, he hadn't imagined that he would be so directly involved in that.
Okay,
Neil said. His delayed response was notable, though not so much as the dullness of his tone. So our timing was mostly coincidental, Stuart continued after a moment. I'll admit, we hurried after your friend rang.
My friend?
Neil felt his brow furrow. Renee Walker, Stuart said. Those two words felt like twin bolts of lightning to Neil's chest. She had my cell phone number. I didn't realize you'd given anyone besides that boy any information.
Neil's lips were numb. I didn't want to put all my eggs in one basket.
Stuart hummed. Smart. She rang me from your phone, said you were missing, and that your father's people had taken you. We didn't have any way to confirm that with our people on the inside. Not that they would have known you by sight anyway. But he took her word for it. Lucky for you.
She asked you to do something?
She had no idea we were so close. Like I said, luckily for me, Neil said over him. He just couldn't believe that Renee had done that. Apparently, that was going to be an ongoing problem tonight. He was stuck on the inside, frozen solid. Like all that physical pain and the shock of the events of the last 24 hours had short-circuited something important inside of him. There was no grief, no horror, and no relief. Not even the anger from before. There was just silence that felt nothing like peace. He said,
"Can I borrow your phone?"
"Jess has a burner, I think," Stuart replied. She's ex-medical corps, by the way. So you're in good hands there. She's even used to working on the move.
I don't care about that,
Neil replied bluntly. No offense. None taken, she replied, with bemusement in her voice, putting a very old-fashioned phone into his good hand. You can keep this one. You might need it if you end up being split up from us. If he had anything inside him, he would already be half mad over what Lola had done to his hand. With it swathed in bandages, there was nothing to see, and with no time for it, there was nothing for him to feel, besides the deep ache of a physical injury. That, like everything else, he would deal with later. He swallowed, dialing one of the many numbers he'd memorized and hitting call. It rang for quite a long time, long enough for Neil to contemplate the fact that it was the middle of the night. Or, by the clock he could just read on the dashboard, the very early hours of the morning. Hello? Said a sleepy voice from the other end. Betsy. Neil. She seemed to shake the sleepiness off just at the sound of his voice. Neil, where are you? Neil ignored that. Do you remember what we talked about? Of course, she said. It was the most unsure he'd ever heard her sound. Somewhere in the recesses of her office, she had a file on him. Notes on what he'd told her, her extrapolations of what had happened to him, the physical markers of the violence he'd endured. He'd signed a waiver on that information and told her, if you need to show this to people, then do that. Because she'd offered weeks ago to help him if he decided to press charges against the Ravens, against Riko and Tetsuji, to get some kind of legal payback for what had been done to him. But that wasn't what he wanted. I need you to take that information and go to Edgar Allan University. Take Renee with you. I'll talk to her. I don't care how you have to do it. I don't care if you have to blackmail the entire school board. But you have to get Jean Moreau out of there. Either he was running out of time, or Jean was. Perhaps both. But this was a promise Neil needed to keep. A final knot in a web he needed to tie. He just had to hope that Jean wasn't in pieces when Betsy and Renee arrived. He knew there was no question about them winning. It was an unfair fight, after all. That was Renee's specialty. Of course, she said, voice transitioning to the warm reassurance that Neil remembered. Thank you. He could have sworn a weight like iron lifted from his shoulders after her agreement. Neil, Betsy began, like she was going to tell him something, or say something that would hurt, even if it were meant to be a comfort. Neil couldn't bear to hear it. He didn't think he could maintain this frozen distance if he did. No, he cut her off. Just, I can't. It was quiet for a long moment. Then she repeated, Of course. I'll do what I need to in order to get Sean out. Thank you, Neil repeated, and then hung up before she could say another word. What are you doing? Stuart demanded. If you need to speak to Ichiro, then organize it. I presume you have an ear with him one way or another. I've got loose ends that need tying, Neil replied. He's not going anywhere. Neil expected that he might be close by, probably closer than Stuart thought. And if not him, a representative of his would be. The Moriyamas had eyes everywhere. Nathaniel, Stuart snapped. Deal with the Lord, then worry about your friends. I didn't go to all this trouble just so you could get yourself killed with your hysterics. Don't pretend you did this because of me, Neil found the voice to snarl back. You're here because of my mother, remember? My priorities are the same as yours. Stuart huffed, but fell silent. They both cared more about family than they did about the cold-eyed Moriyama lords. It was just that Stuart was the only one whose family was tied to him by blood. Renee next, then. Neil dialed his own cell phone number, closed his eyes, and hit call. It only rang three times before it was answered. Who is this? A familiar voice demanded from the other end, without inflection. It wasn't Renee Walker. And despite everything with Jackson Plank not making it, Neil hadn't let himself even dare to hope that this might be the reason why. The silence inside him cracked, with relief. It felt more like the emotion he should have felt instead of a blankness with his face pressed to the back wall of an elevator in WiMAX apartment block, with a gunshot echoing in his ears. Neil gasping, "Andrew," trembled on the way out, too close to breaking. The quiet on the other end took on a different tone entirely.
"Where are you?"
"Nowhere," Neil said, because he didn't have the breath for "in the back of a car on the interstate heading north."
"Don't give me that."
Dangerous now. Neil felt the corners of his mouth twitch upwards despite himself. That hurt, too.
"I know. It doesn't matter," he said. "I just wanted to...
Are you safe?" Typical one-track mind.
"Close enough," Neil replied.
"Are you okay?" Andrew didn't answer the question, instead prompting,
"You just wanted to..."
"I need to talk to Renee," Neil admitted.
"Is she there?"
"She's asleep." "Betsy's coming to get her so they can do something for me," Neil said.
"That's okay. She'll explain it better than me anyway."
"Moreau," Andrew realized, with the same dismissal he seemed to say for Jean in particular.
"What are you doing?"
Neil couldn't really think of a way to explain, not while holding what was left of his nerve. He repeated,
"It doesn't matter. If it works, I'll tell you..."
He wanted to say, "I'll tell you when I get home," but he wasn't sure if he'd get that opportunity, because he didn't really know if he'd be allowed to go home at all. Fox Tower, the Foxhole Court, the Foxes themselves. They felt like a distant dream already, something too good for him to ever have possessed. He'd also inadvertently implied that if what he was doing didn't work, he wouldn't get a chance to explain. Andrew wasn't stupid. He would have deciphered that, and he wouldn't think it was because Neil didn't want to. There was a silence on the other end that dragged. A quiet Andrew wasn't unusual now that he was sober, but for that quiet to feel uncomfortable was. Neil realized partway into it that it was born of something he didn't think he'd ever heard from Andrew before. Uncertainty.
"You still owe me," Andrew said. "Remember?"
Neil swallowed. He was back on the court on Friday night, asking a favor of a bored-looking Andrew because he knew he couldn't stand on his own. He was in Wimac's living room hearing, "You owe me one," from a man who looked at him so steadily it seemed like he was the one making a promise.
"I remember."
Another stretch of silence. Then Andrew said, "Come back." Neil was already shaking, but those two words nearly shattered him.
"I'm not sure that I can."
"I'm not asking for anything you can't give me," Andrew replied. It took Neil a moment to remember why those words sounded familiar. Andrew was quoting him. He forgot sometimes how incredible Andrew's memory was.
"I'll try," Neil said, as much a promise as any other one he'd made and kept.
"But is there anywhere? Can I really?" Andrew was throwing him a lifeline, but Neil was too afraid of it being snatched away to reach for it. People like you and I get tired of wanting what we can't have. Neil hadn't realized quite how true those words were when he'd said them. What he really wanted to ask now, but couldn't force out, was, "Can I really come home?" Andrew said, "Yes." Nothing else. "No one ever offered me anything in my whole life until you made me a deal." Neil had said that, too. He shouldn't have been surprised now. He barely registered the feeling anyway, under the second wave of relief that tried again to drown him.
"I'll try," he repeated, forcing his voice to sound less like a last gasp for air.
"Good," Andrew replied, and then nothing else. It took Neil a moment to register that he'd hung up on him. He couldn't help another twitch of a smile as he lowered the phone from his ear. Typical. He considered being wanted. He considered not being turned away despite all of his considerable faults and failures. To have the man who wanted nothing ask him to come back, to stay. He thought about that for a long moment. Closed his eyes. Let it hurt. Then, chest and mouth aching with clenching longing, he blinked his eyes open and dialed a third time. "How did you get this number?" a calm voice asked from the other end. Nothing like Andrew's kind of cold, a layer of ice constraining what lay underneath it. Ichiro was frozen all the way through. Lord Moriyama, Neil said, using the honorific that technically belonged to Kengo, but was the only one for the job right now. This is Nathaniel Wasninski. I'm hoping that you will do me the honor of meeting with me to speak. Chapter 43. You should give up now. Your friend is as good as dead. Kevin's face said he believed Jackson Plank. Wymack, as protective as ever, had sent the two of them into the kitchen when the cops had finished dragging what information they could out of them. Andrew had the window over the sink cracked, so he could smoke perched on the bench. From this angle, he could see down to the parking lot, where Neil had left the rental car when he'd come here. Kevin, meanwhile, was pacing. Panicking, too. Andrew, uninterested in being charitable, wondered if he was more concerned about Neil or the remainder of the Fox's season. Kevin paused at one end of the empty stretch of linoleum floor, hand tangled in his hair. This is my fault. Don't stroke your own ego, Andrew replied. His face hurt. Without the medication in his system, it was both harder and easier to ignore the ache of deep bruising. He remembered Jackson Plank saying, "If you're looking for the reason why, look in a mirror." It was a needle at the back of his neck. "I'm the reason he came here. If he'd just..." Kevin started, and then cut himself off. If he'd just stayed in West Virginia with Rico and the Ravens, Andrew presumed, as though Neil would be any safer there. Kevin, face twisting like that realization was a bad taste in his mouth, started to pace again. "I warned him that he wasn't going to win against Rico," he went on. He was breathing too quick, working himself towards an anxiety attack. "I don't know why he ever thought he could." Andrew had implied something similar when he said, "You are determined to play the same games as your enemies, but I don't know that you're prepared to go far enough to win." He hadn't been right, because it hadn't been Neil's ruthlessness that had hamstrung him. It was his attachments, the things he cared about. They were the same kind of man, after all. "I knew he was going to get himself killed." Kevin got too close. Andrew reached out and hooked his free hand in the collar of Kevin's shirt, jerking him in. The stitches strained under his fingers. "Kevin," Andrew said. "Shh." That command was a throwback, half unfamiliar on his tongue. It sounded strange out of a mouth with no smile. Less so with just a taste of the electricity inside his skin that he always kept packed down so, so tight. Andrew didn't have time to say anything else before Wymack put his head in the door. "They're leaving." He seemed to process the sight of them after he spoke. Brow furrowed, he snapped, "Andrew, let go of him. And don't smoke in my apartment, you little shit." Andrew had spent most of the morning in this spot doing just that before the apartment had been broken into by goons with guns. He flicked the butt out of the window, pushed Kevin away, and then slid down to the floor. "I'm leaving," he said. "Kevin." He still had a promise left to keep, after all. Kevin, less frightened than Andrew thought he would be, shot him a long look and then nodded. "So am I," Wymack said. "Unless the two of you were planning on breaking the news to the others." Neither of them had planned to do any such thing. Wymack knew that. Nodding at their silence, he turned and led them down to the parking lot. Andrew was surprised when Kevin got into the front passenger seat of the rental car with him over Wymack's car. For all of his comments about Neil, he was no better at doing what was good for him. Andrew didn't just have Neil's phone. He had his keys, too. They were weighty, a heavy mass of metal that fell hard to the floor when they'd been taken from Neil. Andrew knew if he looked, he would find a key for the house in Columbia that Neil had never had the chance to use, but which looked remarkably similar to the tattoo beside his left eye. Helplessness felt like Andrew's grip slipping. His fingers, as adept as ever, started the car and closed on the steering wheel just like they always did, even so. Once back at the tower, Kevin joined Wymack on the floor where the Foxes lived. Rather than join them, Andrew went up to the roof. His mouth already tasted of ashes and smoke. Rather than lighting another cigarette, He walked as close to the edge of the roof as he dared, and then sat cross-legged there. He didn't think of the drop, or the hard landing at the bottom of it. He didn't think about Neil standing on the very edge, wind-whipped and graceful with the adrenaline of playing at being in danger, knowing full well that the only one afraid between the two of them was Andrew. Daring. Long way down. Probably quick, though. Were you hoping to find out? He hadn't been there long when the door opened behind him. Renee said, "Andrew?" To her credit, she didn't sound at all unsure. When he didn't speak, she came and dropped down beside him. Her face, sweet and open, was creased around the edges with worry. "Coach told us what happened. I had an idea." She had a piece of paper, A4, folded, familiar, in her hand. Andrew had one just like it. The difference was that his was a name in English and an encoded string of letters. Hers unfolded to reveal a phone number instead. Stuart Hatford turned out to be more useful than Renee could have imagined. Andrew, who'd thought that if he were anything like his nephew, he'd be utterly ineffective, would have felt reassured if he was that type. As it was, he ignored the sensation of his palms sliding further and further. Once Hatford realized that Renee was legitimately a friend, or something like it, of Neil's, he informed them that they were on Nathan Wisniewski's tail, traveling south from Baltimore. Which was a hell of a lot better than the FBI could apparently do. They hadn't even noticed that there was a third party involved in watching Wisniewski's house. Either that, or they were letting a British man with a grudge do their dirty work these days. Andrew wouldn't have been entirely surprised. When Hatford heard that Neil was going to end up in the same place as Nathan by all likelihood, his voice went hard, focused. He seemed more like a soldier than a commander, but there was an effectiveness that came from that which Andrew could understand. "We'll do our best to help him," he said, which sounded less hopeless than the equivalent statement Browning had made earlier. Less, "We'll bring you back a body," and more, "Maybe he'll only be in a few pieces when we get there." "We'll do our best" meant nothing to Andrew except a willful waste of words. "But understand this now," Hatford said, his voice crackling over the speaker. "If we do find him, there's a very real chance you won't get to see him again anyway." Renee's expression, which was still quietly concerned, shifted. Underneath the pretty smile and the pastel dress code, Renee was just as possessive as Andrew. "I'm sure you'll leave that for him to decide," she said, which was a well-disguised threat. Hatford was quiet for a moment, and then chuckled. "You must be mistaking me for my brother-in-law," he said. "I won't take him anywhere he doesn't want to go. If he has the ability to make a choice, he'll get one." "Thank you," Renee replied diplomatically. When she hung up, with no indication that she was bothered by speaking to someone who was almost certainly a criminal and who was on a mission to hunt down a man called the Butcher of Baltimore, she passed Neil's phone back to Andrew. "Come inside and let me clean your face," she asked, standing and offering him a hand. Andrew let her pull him up. It was closing in on 4 a.m. when the phone in his pocket started buzzing again. "Who is this?" he asked, voice stone. There was a long moment of silence. Then Neil Wisniewski's voice, shaking, said, "Andrew." Every time Andrew thought he'd killed adrenaline outside of life or death necessity, he found he was wrong. He could all of a sudden feel his heart beating in the hollow of his throat. "Where are you?" "Nowhere," Neil said, because he clearly had no idea what a fine line he was walking with Andrew. "Don't give me that," he warned, with an edge. "I don't know. It doesn't matter. I just wanted to..." "It doesn't matter." Andrew's fingers tightened involuntarily. "Are you safe?" "Close enough," Neil replied. The tremor in his voice had transitioned to amusement. Andrew would have liked to think that meant he was telling the truth, but Neil seemed like the type to find humor in the face of his own death. "Are you okay?" Neil had last seen Andrew with a gun held to his head, but Andrew thought the fact he was speaking on the phone now was enough of an indication that he was fine. "You just wanted to..." "I need to talk to Renee," Neil said. "Is she there?" "She's asleep," She would have sat with Andrew all night, but Reynolds had come to collect her eventually, thin-lipped, but as haughty as ever. "Betsy's coming to get her so they can do something for me," Neil said. "That's okay. She'll explain it better than me anyway." There was one very clear connection to be made there. Andrew, his tongue twisting with distaste, said, "Moreau." And then, "What are you doing?" "It doesn't matter. If it works, I'll tell you." "If it works, I'll tell you when I come back." Men like Neil didn't say if unless they were dead, bar the bullet they were waiting for, destined for the grave. Andrew could hear the wavering certainty in his voice and hated it. He'd never had time for resignation. Andrew knew how Neil worked. He would drive that note out of his voice, replace it with something else. After all, Neil kept his promises. It just required Andrew to open his mouth. Swallowing the taste of blood and bleak stubbornness, Andrew said, "You still owe me, remember?"
"I remember."
When it came down to a choice between courage and cowardice, there was only ever one road to take. "Come back."
"I'm not sure that I can." Neil's voice was wavering.
"I'm not asking for anything you can't give me," Andrew replied, because he wasn't that kind of man.
"I'll try," Neil said.
Andrew hated that commitment-free phrase, but from Neil's mouth, it still sounded something like honesty, something like truth.
"But is there anywhere? Can I really..."
He was looking for an anchor, or maybe a lifeline to drag him out from underwater. Andrew said,
"Yes."
"I'll try," Neil repeated in reply. Not a promise, but something like it.
"Good," Andrew said. Then he hung up.
"Come back." Andrew closed his fingers around the fragile shell of Neil's phone and fought the urge to reduce it to pieces. His entire life he'd been called the epicenter of a disaster. Earthquake, hurricane, the kind of bomb that leveled buildings. The kind with collateral damage. Except Andrew, a precision weapon of a man, had never caused any such thing. He wanted to break something. He didn't. This disaster was on the inside, and echoing it outside wouldn't do anything to stop it.
"Who was that?"
someone asked from behind him in a sleep rough voice. When Andrew turned, he found Aaron in the lounge doorway, arms crossed. His brother's eyes went straight to the blackening bruise on Andrew's cheekbone before moving to meet his gaze. He seemed to be trying to pick something from Andrew's face. Right now, they matched. Andrew had put a bruise in almost the same place on Aaron as the one Jackson had given him.
"Did you lose your nerve?"
Andrew still wasn't sure if applying his fist to Aaron's face had been confirmation or denial of that. Andrew hadn't noticed Aaron come in, but his face was more readable than Andrew's.
"Still listening in on phone calls?"
He remembered Aaron snarling through a bathroom door, "I wish I'd never known about you, you fucking..." punctuated by something colliding with it. A foot or a fist. He'd certainly come out of there with bruises over both. Sweat-limbed, but clear-eyed and no longer jonesing for another fix. Andrew, sitting on the floor across the hall from the door, watching it for signs of imminent escape, had replied, "Hindsight is 20/20, brother." Aaron now looked unbothered, which was a new development.
"So you asked him to come back.
Are you going to make another protest?" Andrew asked. Instead of silken, his voice came out rough from his throat. Aaron blinked slowly.
"No, I was just thinking that you were right. We really are the same."
They were twins. They were nothing and everything alike at once.
"Did you just realize that?"
"Actually, no," Aaron replied. "I've been thinking that for a while now." Andrew didn't answer. Aaron went on, weary and incautious. Unafraid, even with the marks of Andrew's hands still on him. "When you said that he didn't mean anything to you, was it him you were lying to, or yourself? Because I said exactly the same thing to Caitlin when I told her to stay away from me, and I'm still not sure which of those two options it was for me." Nothing and everything alike was right. So you think I might be able to give you some clarity? No. I don't think you know the answer any better than I do, Aaron said. Andrew told Renee he believed in three things, none of which were any kind of God. Human nature, truth, and promises, the binding kind, the only thing in the entire world that he would bend a knee for. Hey, Andrew, he said. Hey, brother. Make another deal with me. Chapter 44. Stuart dropped him off in a quiet park in the middle of the city. He gave Neil a long, probing look before he left, and then said, If I don't hear from you in 48 hours, I'll ring your teammate. Neil shrugged. Good luck. Jess leant between the front seats. You really need to see a medical professional in the near future, okay? Neil waved her off and turned to go. It was early enough on a Sunday morning that the park was deserted, which was lucky because Neil must have looked like a shambling wreck. He located a park bench out of sight of any cameras and sat down, ignoring the way the dew soaked through his jeans. It was hardly the worst thing on them. He did, at least, have on a shirt that someone had procured for him under the oversized jacket. It rubbed uncomfortably against the dressing on his back. He didn't have to wait long. He'd been there lost in thought while staring at a water feature for perhaps 20 minutes when a voice spoke in Japanese from behind him. You will follow me, the man said. Neil started to turn his head, realized he couldn't, and then spun on his ass to face him instead. The stranger wore a dark suit and a serious expression. Behind him, there was a pair of black cars, lean, muscled, and expensive. Neil looked from him to them and then said, No. His expression didn't change. No. No, Neil repeated. His skin was crawling in a way that boded ill for the future of his traveling anywhere via car with strangers. The memory of being in the trunk, of being enclosed, was so visceral he thought he might be back in there if he dared to blink. And if the alternative is dying here and now? Neil raised his hands from his sides in an exaggerated shrug. Just do it. I'm not in a state to make it difficult for you. The man nodded and turned on his heel, walking back towards the cars. Neil watched him for a few seconds and then turned back himself. If they shot him, a very real risk. He'd prefer not to see it coming. This was just another bargain, another moment of recklessness, in a long string of them for Neil, one that could backfire any second. It would be luck and his gut instinct if all of this, paid off. Death never came. He heard footsteps, and then another figure in a dark suit and coat sat beside him. Ichiro Moriyama was brutally familiar, both from the last time Neil had spoken with him and because of his similarity to Riko. There was a kind of stillness in his face that Riko didn't have, though. It was control, pure and simple. It was something that Neil needed to match if he wanted to survive this. He exhaled and pushed everything down. Neither sentimentality nor pain had a place in deals like this. Right now, he had to be his father's son. He didn't dare speak first. He watched Ichiro in silence and waited while he was scrutinized in return by Ichiro's level dark stare. You have caused my family a considerable amount of trouble, he observed. I apologize for the inconvenience, Lord Moriyama, Neil said. That was never my intention. Intentions are of little importance, Ichiro replied. You have crossed innumerable lines despite promising when you pled your case that your only interest was in playing that ridiculous sport. You have proven yourself to be a liability. Are you surprised that my father saw fit to have you killed? No, Neil replied. I'm surprised you agreed to meet with me at all. Something flickered in Ichiro's eyes. Why do you think that is? It was a trick question, of sorts. Neil knew the answer. He said, It could be because you're not your father. Perhaps you don't believe me to be a liability like he does. Perhaps you were just interested to hear why your father's best and most trusted people still couldn't kill me. But I don't think that's it. I think that you are merely interested in what I have to say.
Ichiro inclined his head in iota, a prompt to go on.
He was affording Neil a great favor to speak freely, and he could withdraw it at any moment. With that in mind, Neil didn't wait.
Lola Malcolm said I'd been sentenced to death because of what happened to Proust.
Presumably because your father owned him, or at least thought he did.
I think your father might not know who Proust really belonged to when he died.
But I think you do, Neil said, slowly, though not out of caution.
Every word was deliberate.
I think you've set a cunning trap for your brother, and that I'm just a pawn to you.
Lola hadn't known why Neil had arranged for Proust to die, just that he had killed a man on Kengo's payroll. She'd talked about Rico like he was responsible in part for Neil being taken, but the derision in her voice had been clear.
Phil Higgins had said New York to Seattle when he brought up Rico's money trail.
It was a trap.
Not for Neil, and not for Nathan. Neil didn't think Stewart had factored into the planning at all. But for the self-styled Raven King, whose throne his brother was planning on ripping from under him. He and I have an enmity that is public knowledge. It wouldn't exactly be a stretch to believe that he would pay to have my father set free, not if evidence about him paying off cops and criminals in Oakland also came to light after an extensive police investigation. Hence why Higgins was still alive despite what he'd found.
I'd be dead. My father and his circle would be in the wind, and there would be plenty of evidence pointing straight at Rico, leaving the main branch spotless.
Ichiro's second nod was just final confirmation, though it still sent cold relief through him.
He's competition to you. He's a threat.
I told you that months ago, Neil continued.
I can see now that I didn't need to.
Your point. There was no hint of his thoughts on his face.
The fact that I'm still alive is an issue for you, but it doesn't need to be, Neil replied.
I can give you what you want.
I promised to do that before Christmas. It was just your brother I promised.
What is it that you'll give me? Ichiro said, voice like the fine edge of a very sharp knife.
I'll take care of Rico myself if you like, Neil said.
I know your brother well, and I've always hated him, but I was content to contain our disagreements to the Exe Court. He made a mistake when he involved other people, though, and he was stupid about it. I told him I'd destroy his reputation, and I will.
I'll even kill him for you. It would be my pleasure.
Or, Ichiro said, I could kill you now and have done.
Neil looked back at him, still as a stone on the inside.
I thought you might say that.
Did you?
Yes, Neil replied.
He could already imagine it. He doubted Ichiro would be the type to drag it out.
A single bullet, probably.
Head or chest.
He went on.
That's why I made a contingency plan.
It didn't look as though Ichiro was expecting that.
Maybe he had thought that Neil was the kind to die quietly, despite all the evidence to the contrary.
And what might that be?
I knew that at some point I might do something you didn't agree with. I knew I didn't have much in the way of leverage to get out of that.
So I decided to find some, he replied.
Does the name Kadamatsu mean anything to you?
Ichiro didn't react, just stared at Neil for a very long moment.
Where did you hear that name?
I did some research, Neil replied. When he had asked his uncle who the Moriyamas might be afraid of, that was the name that had come up.
I rang in a few favors. I didn't want to get hasty. I wasn't sure whether I would need the information that I found. So I gave it to someone so they could use it in the event of my untimely death. Just as a precaution, you understand.
Ichiro blinked once, slow like a big predator.
A precaution?
He meant, not a threat?
Neil said, Rico might have forgotten who he was dealing with.
I never did. Not with him, and not with any of you.
I wanted to end this year alive. I was prepared to do whatever I had to in order to ensure that happened. But I also don't mean any harm to your line. It's the other branch I have an issue with.
You understand that, if I wanted to, I could find every person you've ever told about that family and make sure they never got a chance to talk, Ichiro said.
You could try, Neil replied.
The words tasted like a challenge on his tongue, Like pure adrenaline. At the end of the day, they were a threat. This was Neil holding his ground, playing the game he was born to play. Rico had never stood a chance against his brother, and he never really had against Neil either. He wasn't a firstborn son. He didn't have what it took to be here face to face like the two of them were, so focused on his messy web and ruling his disciples from a castle that was already crumbling. "So, you end my brother for me," Ichiro said. "What is it that you want in return?" He made it sound as though Neil didn't have much to bargain. Neil said, "My life. Those of Kevin Day and Jean Moreau. For all of us to maintain our freedom from Edgar Allan going forwards, and to be able to play Exie as we choose in exchange for our professional earnings. Just a variation on the deal we already made. That's all it has to be. Day is already free. But Moreau is still a raven," Ichiro commented. "I won't arrange the termination of his contract over this. He's worth more to me there than he is playing for another college team." "He'll be dead before the year's out if he stays at Evermore," Neil replied. Of that, he had no doubt. He'd seen the new scars Jean had carved into himself at his first banquet as a fox. He'd read the desperate message Jean had sent him in the wake of Kengo's hospitalization. "You told me not to do anything stupid, but I can't hold out. And the Ravens might have him for now, but they won't for long." "Excuse me?" "The Ravens are insular, but the board of Edgar Allan can't ignore serious allegations of abuse within the team. Or evidence of it," Neil said. "Every inch of my skin is proof. So is Jean's. And they're about to hear all about it if they haven't already. Betsy and Renee would be most of the way there by now, at least. Perhaps already at the school." Neil could only hope that Jean had held out these last few days, that they would be bringing out someone tentatively alive from the dorms underneath the Ravens Stadium, and not a corpse. Neil had always intended to keep his promises. He'd been chipping away at Rico's foundation for weeks, for months, and now the entire structure would crumble with a few well-placed blows. He was ready to deliver them. He let Ichiro read that willingness from his face. "I feel that I may have underestimated you, Butcher," Ichiro said after a long moment of silence. "It's a common mistake, Lord Moriyama," Neil acknowledged. He refused to wince at being called that title. It wasn't the first time. "I wouldn't have lived this long otherwise." Ichiro's gaze was iron and stone. "You make a convincing case for yourself. Your methods are weak and clumsy, but there is something of your father in you. So, you have a deal under the terms we've discussed, except for one thing. You can do whatever you like to my brother's reputation, but his life still belongs to the main branch." Which means that Rico was still Ichiro's to kill as he pleased. Neil's heart was pounding. "Thank you, Lord Moriyama. You have a limited amount of time. I won't wait forever," Ichiro went on, as though Neil hadn't spoken. "I will speak with my father on your behalf." He stood, but turned to face Neil with the advantage of height. "You understand that if you ever mention that name again, I will hurt everyone you care about and then kill them. Starting with Day and Moreau." Neil wanted to say, "Don't make it so I have to." He realized that that was inadvisable. He nodded his agreement instead. Ichiro watched him for a moment longer, before walking away, disappearing out of Neil's range of vision. He waited for the cars to both start and then drive away, before turning himself to ensure that they were gone. Nothing. The little parking lot was empty. Neil felt a trickle of relief that wanted to be a flood, held back by a dam of tightly woven control, and he didn't let it out. Instead, he pulled out the burner phone and powered it back on. Browning sounded snappish when he answered his cell phone, the number Neil had saved to his own phone and then memorized along with the others when he realized he might need them. "Who is this?" "My father's dead," Neil said. "Guess that means you get your information now." "Where the hell are you?" Browning demanded. Neil told him the address and then waited while he spoke with someone else. "I've sent the local police department to send out a unit to pick you up," he said, voice brisk. Should I send an ambulance, too? Neil shrugged, even though Browning couldn't see it. It hurt his back. I'm not dead yet. I'll take that as a yes, then, Browning replied, and said as much to whoever was with him. Then he said to Neil, Where have you been? We found a warehouse full of bodies and hog-tied criminals hours ago, but no sign of you. I've got every police department from Palmetto to Baltimore on red alert looking for you. You know that? I didn't realize you cared that much, Neil said. You're our best witness against your father's people, Browning replied. Also, you're a kid who was kidnapped by known criminals and murderers who has been missing for more than 12 hours. By all rights, you should be dead. I'm going to be interested to hear why you aren't. I'm not that easy to kill, Neil informed him, standing and shuffling closer to the parking lot. Now that the adrenaline he'd been running on was fading, he was beginning to feel utterly wrung out. Too much blood loss, too much pain, and too little sleep. I'm beginning to realize that, Browning said. Neil could hear sirens, getting closer. He was close to the city center, but they had to be breaking inner-city speed limits to be arriving so fast. They know I'm not running, right? Browning muffled the speaker for a second, and then came back with, Just keep your hands visible, Nathaniel. With pleasure. Neil dropped himself to his knees as gently as he could on the dew-wet grass, and then folded his free hand against his skull. See you soon, Fed.